But I would like to know what some of your favorite Bible characters are and why. Favorite Bible characters and why. And so I'll start with Samantha. Ruth. Okay.
Because she's crazy.
So she likes her because she's crazy. Okay. Yeah, she was. She just took the instructions of her mother-in-law, loved her mother-in-law, stuck with her, and she didn't want Moab. She didn't want to go back to the gods of Moab. That's awesome. Ruth, wonderful. All right, I'm going to pick on you. Who your favorite? Jerry Van Cleve, who's your favorite Bible character and why? Other than Jesus, we know Jesus is he's the hero of all heroes, but other Bible characters?
Peter.
And why?
When I felt called into the ministry, his life of rejecting the Lord and then the Lord asking him to give up me is what motivated me to get into ministry, to feed his lambs.
Feed the sheep. That is awesome, man. Peter, how about you? Somebody raise your hand. Tell me, who is your favorite Bible character and why? Yes. Who?
Zacchaeus.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that guy. Zacchaeus. Could have used him as a little known Bible character, because even though he only appears in the scriptures just a brief time, I guess his story is a little better known. You know, Zacchaeus was a wee little man. I mean, who cannot remember that one? You want me to sing the rest of that, don't you? No, I'm not going to. All right, somebody else, your favorite Bible. Okay, Cole.
David.
Well, he's a great. Why is that lame? Why is he your favorite?
Because he's like everyone knows. That's what I mean.
I mean, you like him because he's just.
Of course you do. That's what I mean.
But, yeah.
I just like his courage at a young age. All of Israel was trembling because of that one giant man. And then he's not even there to fight him. He's just like, who is this guy who's taunting Israel?
Yeah.
What are you guys talking about?
Yeah. David. Especially at the first, whenever he was young and God used him to fight the giant. That is an awesome thing. Good. All right. Somebody else. Favorite Bible characters. Aaron.
I've got two. I love the faith of the centurion with the sick daughter.
Yep. That's awesome.
He finally believes Jesus can heal him. He said, hey, you know, I'm a man of authority. I tell somebody to do something, doesn't I know that you, whatever you want done, it'll happen. You just say the word.
Great faith. Jesus said that about him.
Jehu.
He was
zealous for carrying out. He did a lot of stuff.
He did. In a hurry. Jehu. Do you drive furiously? Jehu. All right. Yes, sir. Right here.
I like Paul because he was hard-headed and arrogant.
Yeah.
And opinionated against Jesus and became a believer. Became just as hard-headed and opinionated toward Jesus.
That's right. You know, people that are very, very, very strong of character and very strong in their drive, boy, if you can win those people to the Lord, their character doesn't change a whole lot. They just turn it around, you know? That is absolutely awesome. Paul, and I like a lot of Bible characters, but I guess I'm going to have to agree with you. That's my favorite, other than Jesus, my favorite Bible character is the Apostle Paul. All right, anybody else? Yeah, come on, Joe. Elijah.
I just love when he's facing the prophets of Baal.
Yeah.
And he's mocking, where's your God?
Yeah. you like that, you like that snarkiness just a little bit. Yeah. Elijah was like that. You know, it's funny. I'll just give you guys a little heads up. When I'm done with this little people with a big impact, I gave it to Greg. You want to know what I was going to do next? We only have a little six-week period of time before we're going to do a long summer thing with men. I'm going to be involved with men during the summer. And I'm going to do a little short thing. I'm going to call it the Age of Miracles. And I'm going to focus on Elijah and Elisha. And I'm going to pick the top six miracles. There was, how many was there between them? Do you guys know, Bible scholars? Between Elijah and Elisha, there were, remember, Elisha asked for a double portion and he got it. You remember? 21 miracles, 7 for Elijah, 14 for Elisha. Well, in any event, I'm going to pick 6 out of those 21, and I'm going to teach about the age of miracles, and we'll talk about those two guys. And the reason I'm doing that is that during the tribulation, as we've been studying in Revelation, you know, there's going to be a lot of deception, and miracles are going to be abundant. At least they're going to seem like miracles, and they're going to be doing them during the tribulation period. But these two guys, at a time when you couldn't count on the kings of Israel and you couldn't count on the priest, but these two prophets came on the scene, and you know, they were kind of the voice for God during that time, and God gave them a little bit of punctuation power. You know, whenever they wanted to give a message, they punctuated it with these incredible miracles, you know. And so I'm going to talk about them. What I was going to say is when Ahab, I've just read this because I was studying for this. When Ahab, who was a wicked, wicked, wicked king, when he was suffering through the 3 years, some odd months of no rain, you remember that? It didn't rain or everything. And so he sent some messengers out. Says, go find Elijah. You know, you're meant to send 50 out, you know, a captain and his 50. And they were going to go find Elijah. And he sent messengers, and Elijah met them as they were coming. And he stopped the messengers, and they said, Ahab has sent us to find you. And he says, you go tell Ahab that, it's not going to rain except according to the word of the Lord. And so whenever they came back to Ahab, they said, hey, we were trying to find Elijah. Elijah found us. And here's what he has to say to you. You know, you're the cause of all the trouble. And so whenever he did, the Ahab asked the messengers, what did he look like? And they said, oh, he was a hairy man all over, and he was wearing had a big leather waistband on. Well, who in the New Testament is like that?
John the Baptist.
And so he is called what in the New Testament? Elijah. Remember that? And Jesus even said, and if you can receive it, he is Elijah who was to come. Speaking of John the Baptist. But I mean, he was a wild guy. Elijah really was something. He was completely, totally different. All right, anybody else? I want to get started on what do you got, Jim?
Hezekiah.
Yeah, he did. He spread it before the Lord. He was a great leader. Made a couple of mistakes late in life, but he was a tremendous, tremendous leader and rededicated the whole nation to the Lord, opened up the temple, started temple worship again, cleaned out the pagan stuff that was going on. All right, I'll take one more. Anybody else? Favorite? Okay, Vic.
A cousin of mine gave a sermon about...
Is he in the Bible?
He stands.
Okay, I'm kidding. Brother of encouragement.
Barnabas was. So I often think of that when I'm meeting somebody or just talking an encouragement.
Yeah. You got to go out of your way to be an encourager. Has to be something that, I mean, it's not just natural. It's something you have to do on purpose and takes effort, you know. All right, time's going to get away. Maybe we'll get some more next time. But we're talking about the little people. We're talking about the ones not known so much. So we're going to talk about another one. We're back for another look at little people that made a big impact. Last time we talked about a little child. In last week's lesson, the little fellow was, he himself was the object lesson, the little boy. He was the object lesson, and he didn't have to do anything. His existence was enough for Jesus to say, this is in Matthew chapter 18 and 19, the first 14 or 15 verses. It's enough for Jesus to say this, look, we resolve conflicts, we forgive one another, we keep our marital vows, and we do all of this because this little boy's standing right here. In other words, because the children are watching, we deal with our conflicts. We don't let them go. We forgive one another because we don't want to teach them to be unforgiving and vengeful. And also, we keep our marital vows because the children are watching. So his warning was, this is how we wrapped it up last time, his warning was that anyone by their behavior, their attitude, or disregard for the children, and they put a stumbling block by this behavior, attitude, or disregard, if they put a stumbling block in front of a child, they were in for severe, severe judgment. Jesus even said it'd be better for them to put what around their neck? Millstone. He says, and so if you're, this is the context. This is the very context in which Jesus said, and if your right hand offends you, what? And if your right eye offends you, what? Cut it out. In other words, is he really talking about, you know, sadomasochism? Is that what he's trying to get people to? No, that's not it. He's saying you need to take radical action because you better not be the one to offend, stumble, or put an obstacle in front of the little children. And boy, as we ended last week, you guys had all kinds of suggestions about things that sometimes we as adults do that are obstacles and hindrances to kids coming to faith in Jesus and following him. How many times do the kids throw up their hands in families when they see the parents say one thing and then do another, you know, and just live a completely different way? Well, I don't want to reteach that one. Today we got another person, and it's another little guy, another little lad. We're going to talk about the Lord, the lad, and the lunch. And you immediately know what I'm talking about when I talk about the Lord, the lad, the lunch. How many of you had Sunday school teachers that were really good at teaching that story and you can still remember those stories? I can, man. I mean, it was like Jesus in the boat. I had a story about that one. I had another one. I had another teacher that was just fantastic, and he brought bread, you know, and he sliced it all up, and I don't know where he got it from, a bakery or what, but he brought bread to the class, and I mean, it smelled so good, and the kids we were all in the class, and we were all so hungry, we were almost crying by the time he started passing out the bread, because it smelled so good. We thought he just brought it to feed us, but he didn't. He brought it for an illustration, but he did let us have the bread. So we're going to look at it. So take your Bibles, and we're going to go to John chapter 6, one of the most famous stories in the Scriptures, and it is a story that many times is taught all by itself, but there's more to it than just that story, and we're going to talk about that for just a little bit tonight. So chapter 6, verse 1, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. It's also called the Sea of Gennesaret. Anytime you see the word Gennesaret, Galilee, Tiberias, you're talking about the same place. Then a great multitude followed him because they saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" But this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, but what are they among so many?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down in number, about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost." Therefore they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, "Truly, this is truly the prophet who is to come into the world." Curious phrase, that last part. Let me just read it again. "Truly, this is the prophet who is come into the world." One of the heroes of the Jews in that day was Moses. Moses was mentioned many, many times. They brought up Moses as, their forefather and the prototypical type of person that a good Jew would want to be. And he was a prophet, and he was a father of the people. He was the deliverer. I mean, they loved Moses. That phrase right there, Moses was told by Jesus to tell them that I'm going to raise up a prophet just like you. Well, Moses, when he was with them in the wilderness, what did God use him to do through him? What was provided for the people morning and evening for 40 years? Manna. What is manna? Well, it's a little coriander seed, but they would make bread, cakes, and all kinds of things. So basically, sustenance, bread Moses was used by God. Now, Moses didn't give him anything. God gave it to him. All Moses did was tell him what to do once it was there. But they looked at Moses as the great provider. Moses, he's the one. They think that this prophet, surely the prophet that was prophesied has come. And that's all the way back in Deuteronomy. So Moses, he was the prototype, and they think that Jesus is the prophet that was going to come, the one that was going to do things like Moses did. Several other things in the passage you need to clear up. Look at verse number 4. Why does it take time to say, now the Passover of the Jews was near? There's not an insignificant phrase anywhere in the Scriptures. Well, the reason that is very, very important is that the Passover happened on a Saturday or on a Friday, and then it was followed by a Saturday of rest on which the feast of what kind of bread began? Unleavened bread. It was the feast of unleavened bread. Jesus, in this entire passage, now I'm giving you a little bit of background so you can understand this passage a little bit better. Jesus is the unleavened bread from heaven that has come down. To what did leaven always picture? It was the penetrating, permeating nature of the, could have been of the Pharisees. It was evil that permeated society. And so when the people had to get the leaven out of their homes for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, it wasn't just get the leaven out of the bread, it was get the leaven out of their life. Get the evil out of your life. Confess your sins, clean up the house, get the dirt out, get everything. Just for 8 days now, you're just going to eat nothing but this bread with no leaven, and you're going to just behave yourself and do right and act right and focus on God. You're not going to do anything else. That's what you're going to do. It's a very, very holy time. Jesus is the bread of life. Jesus is the unleavened, therefore uncorruptible, uncorrupted, sinless. Nothing wrong with Jesus. Would you agree with that? Was there anything wrong with Jesus? No. No, he was sinless. And so this Passover, there's something else about the Passover. The Passover happened on the 14th day of the first month of the Jews, the spiritual calendar, and that would have been like May, June. And so when he says, have them sit down on the what? On the grass, it tells you what time of year it was. It was in June, and there's going to be another feeding, and there's going to feed 4,000. They're going to be in the very same location, but what do they sit on? The dirt. No grass. So it tells you what's going on. It's very important to this story. I want you to see this as we get into it. It's a fantastic, fantastic story. But back to the little boy. This is the story of the feeding of the 5,000 men, which means there were probably about 20,000 in attendance because you only registered the heads of families, and that's what they were doing. There's 5,000 men there, and could have been up to 20,000 people counting the women and the children. This all-time favorite Sunday school teacher, favorite of Sunday school teachers, is also a favorite of preachers. And I don't know if you knew this, it's one of the few narratives that is told in all four Gospels. There are very few of the Bible stories, even miracles, that are told in all four Gospels. This is one of them. Even the virgin birth of Jesus is not told in all four Gospels. But this story is. It's a very, very significant passage. As is always the case, the story is part of a bigger story that all point to the deity and authority of Jesus. And by the way, that's what Jesus was doing with his miracle works that he was doing on earth. He did not come to give bread to every human perpetually at the time he came on earth. He didn't come to heal all of the people at the pool of Siloam. He only healed how many? How many did he heal? Do you remember? One. He didn't go to every town and raise everybody that died. It's just a few here and there. He showed that he had power over death. He had power over sickness. He had power over blindness. He had power over people who were lame, people who had withered hands. He was showing that he had authority in the spiritual world, the physical world, the world of death. He just plain had authority, and that's what he was showing. So the miracle was that Jesus fed a lot of people with a little bit of food, but it's connected to the passages before and after it. I mentioned a moment ago, Moses was the great hero of the Jews. Now let me say this clearly. He was the great hero of the Jews at the time that this was written in the New Testament. That is, at least he was a great hero after he was dead. Think back for a moment and let's talk about how well did they treat Moses, the Jews, when he was alive? Everything he said to do, even if it came directly from the voice of God, even after he came down off of the mountain with his face glowing to the point that he had to wear a veil over his face just to keep so that they could even look at him and not scare him to death, knowing that he'd been in contact with God, even under that situation, they still murmured and complained and bellyached. Everything he said to do, they wanted to know why. And I mean, it was tough. I mean, there was the sons of Korah. And there was all kinds of stuff. Moses was their hero. He was their hero once he was dead. Jesus said this to the Pharisees. He says, man, you need to fill up the measure of your fathers. You build the tombs of the prophets. Your fathers killed them and you build their tombs. In other words, you're building tombs and memorials to the people that your fathers killed. Interesting, huh? So they rebelled against Moses' leadership endlessly while he was alive. At the end of chapter 5, Jesus himself brought up Moses. So let's look at that. Look at it says there in verse 44. How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes only from God? Do not think I shall accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? In other words, they venerated Moses, and so he took Moses out and pointed to him and said, look, you guys have worshiped Moses, but if you just read a little closer, paid a little more attention, he wrote about me. Jesus speaking of himself. So this is the setting that the story is in. After the amazing feeding of the 5,000, the Jews were elated. They ran after Jesus. Down in verse number 26, Jesus says, I know why you're here. You're not here because of the sign or because of me. You're here because you ate the bread and you want some more. And that's what they wanted. They had missed the point of Jesus' teaching. So it was after that that they brought up that Jesus' miraculous feeding of the multitude was impressive, but not as impressive as Moses, because Moses, their forefather, had given them bread. They said, Moses gave us bread for 40 years. All you did was furnish lunch. You see the point? And so they misunderstood completely. What they wanted was a miracle-working prophet to give them what they wanted and supply their need right here, right now on planet Earth. But Jesus was offering himself not as temporary bread, but as the bread of life. So that's the setting of the whole thing. The Passover was near, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and so on. And then we have this story that comes to illustrate the authority that God has over all situations, Jesus had over all situations, and then just exactly who he used to prove that point. So first thing I want you to write down is the people had a problem. The people had a problem. And what was their basic problem? We just read the story. They were in a desert place. If you read the other accounts in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, yeah. They were a long way from town. They had been with Jesus all day long. You've been teaching them from early morning, no break, and it's late in the day. Maybe the sun's beginning to set. And so the people had a problem. They were going to faint on the way. They just really needed some help. So the first letter there, the multitude lacked resources. They didn't have what they needed. They were a long way out. They were in a deserted place. They had been with Jesus all day. Matthew 13:14-15 says, and Jesus had been teaching them. They were faint. They were hungry. They were in need. And so that's the situation with the people, the multitude, the 5,000 men plus women and children. And then the next thing, write this down, the disciples lacked compassion. The disciples lacked compassion. You can read all four accounts and you can find that in none of those accounts did the disciples really want to do anything about that situation. What did they, do you remember what they actually said in some of the other passages? Anybody remember if you can just think about it? Very, very clearly in the Luke passage, they said to Jesus, send them away. Send them away. Interestingly, Jesus says, you give them something to eat. He turned and looked at the disciples and he said, you give them something to eat. Jesus, they wanted Jesus to send them away. And so they wanted them to just go to the towns and villages, get on your way home and find something. Luke 9:12 says that. So this is not only this what Jesus is doing with the disciples. This is not just a ministry tour where Jesus was establishing his credentials, which he was doing that, but it was on-the-job training for his disciples. We know that's true because he gave them power over demons. He gave them authority to heal the sick. I mean, they were with him. They were working with him. Sometimes they believed and did well. Sometimes they didn't believe and, you know, they sank in the water like Peter. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on in the ministry life of Jesus. But he was showing them his authority, who he was, and at the same time, he was training them for ministry. Mark 6:34 said that Jesus did have compassion. As a matter of fact, all of the passages do. But compassion was lacking on the part of the disciples. And I think I could pull over and say that sadly, compassion is lacking today, even among believers. In fact, from time to time, I hear even Christians say when they're talking about people in their situations, well, you know, I'm just not a person with very much compassion. Ha, ha, ha. As if that's some badge of honor that we should say we are not compassionate. Well, I mean, if we're going to be like Christ, are we supposed to be like Christ or not? I mean, isn't Christ-likeness the ultimate goal of Christianity? I think in Philippians, I've heard a lot of good preaching from Philippians last night. I've got a class with preachers in it, and they were preaching, and all of them have to preach from Philippians. And last night, we were looking in chapter 3, and we're talking about the fact that Paul wanted to lay hold of that for which Jesus had laid hold of him. And then the next verse says that he would press on, push on for the upward call of God. Christ's likeness is the goal of God. Romans 8:29, I think, is the most clear verse in all the Bible. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. The purpose of God and will of God for every Christian is to become more like Jesus. So they were doing on-the-job training, and Jesus said, look, I think today's lesson is going to be in compassion. And so he sets up the scenario, 5,000 men, all these people out in the middle of they're in this deserted, not desert, but deserted place, long way from food, water, and all the necessities, and he was going to show them what it means to be full of compassion. Letter C, the disciples also lacked understanding. They lacked understanding. So the people lacked resources, the disciples lacked compassion, and the disciples also lacked understanding. You know, when God's people lack understanding and they don't know where to go and whom to trust in a crisis, then how will the world ever learn anything from us? How many of you, you know, don't raise your hand, you don't have to give testimony or anything, but let's just in your own mind's eye, how many of you have run into trouble, run into a crisis, run into a situation, you've got under circumstances that were just untenable, impossible, you just, and boy, you wish you could point back and say, you know what, I just, in that case, I just fell on my knees and went to God and pleaded with him to help me in that situation, or sometimes we have to admit we get in those impossible situations and instead of pleading with God, we accuse God. God, I thought you know, I'm your servant. I thought you were going to take care of me. And look, here I am in all this trouble. You know, if Christians melt in difficult moments, where is the world supposed to look for their example? Where are they supposed to look to know what to do in the time of a crisis? And see, the disciples, they lacked understanding. Not only did they lack compassion, but they lacked understanding that he was training them to be the people, the go-to people. And that's who Christianity, that's who we're supposed to be. Now, we can't feed everybody, fix everybody, help everybody, we can't solve all the problems in the world, but we sure know how to behave under pressure. And we know how to act under those situations. So the disciples considered that their resources were insufficient to meet the needs, and they were right. But they were wrong, ever thinking that they might supply the needs of the multitudes anyway. And let me just give a summary statement. We are never going to be able to supply the world's needs. But then again, God has not asked us to supply the world's needs. Who is it that supplies the world's needs? God does. Who brings the sun up? God does. Who brings the rain? Who makes the crops work? That whole system. I mean, how does that work? Well, you know, God does that. And so God's the one that's got to be in charge. So the people had a problem. Now the second point, look at it. the lad had a lunch. This has got to be the simplest lesson that you've ever heard. But the people had a problem. Now the lad had a lunch. So Jesus, letter A, he puts the disciples to a test. And he says, look at verse number 5. Chapter 6, verse number 5 says, Jesus lifted up his eyes, seeing a great multitude coming toward him. You know, he's done teaching now. Teaching time's over. Now they're coming forward to him, and he knows what they need. And he said to Philip, where shall we buy bread that these may eat? Verse 6, but this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Isn't that a wonderful statement? Jesus always knows what to do. How many have ever been in a situation you did not know what to do? All right? But at the same time, God always knows what he's going to do. And he knows exactly how to handle it. And so Jesus put the disciples to a test. Where will we get food to feed the people? And I have a question. Do you think Jesus ever lacks information? Do you think he was asking this question to them to try to find out some information? Do you think any test that God's ever put anybody through in history, he was trying to actually find out how they would respond? Or did he already know how they were going to respond before the test ever came? He's God. He's Alpha and Omega. He's beginning and the end. He's the God who was and is to come. I mean, time means nothing to him. All of history plays out like a play before him. He's seen it all. He knows what you're going to do, Samantha. He knows everything. He knows what you're thinking, what you thought, what you're going to do. The prayers you pray, he knows what you're going to pray before you pray it. He knows the sincerity of you. All of us, we're all there. He knows. Jerry, he knows everything. So why the test? Let me give you this a little bit. Jesus put disciples to the test. Where are we going to get the food? Jesus never lacks information. And we could ask the question, do you think he wonders how we will come out in a test? No. When God tests us, it is not so that he can find out where we are spiritually. It is to reveal to us where we are spiritually. Who do you think learned the most that day? God? Or let me put it this way. Did Jesus learn more about the disciples, or did the disciples learn more about themselves? The second. They learned about themselves. My mentor and fellow missionary in Peru, Tom Pace, I've used this many times, and I hope you don't get tired of it. But it was a radical moment in my life. We were in Peru, and there was all kinds of, it was tough times. I won't even go into it, but there was terrorism going on. And he gave this statement. He says, you know, Phil, he says, your circumstances, problems, and difficulties do not make us who we are. They reveal to us who we are. Our circumstances, problems, and difficulties don't make us. They reveal us. It's just like, you know, it's like this cup of water right here. I've got this cup of water right here, and if I, you know, as long as everything's calm, cool, and collected, you know, I mean, there's nothing happening. That water, everything's cool, it's just calm, and it stays right in the cup. But if we come along and there's trouble, and I'm not going to do it because I don't want to spell it, but if I shake this table and everything, what's going to come out of that cup? And you know what happens to us when we get tested and tried and shook up in life? Do you know what comes out? What comes out of us? What's in us? What's in us? Is it faith? Is it trust? Or is it complaints? And is it murmur? You see what I'm saying? That's what's going to happen. And so this is what the circumstances and problems of our life do. They reveal who we are and reveal what is inside of us. Now, the disciples, Philip and Andrew, they got practical. Write that down. They got practical. So Philip, it says here, he says to Philip, where are we going to buy bread? He said to him, for he himself knew what he'd do. And so Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many? So here's the scenario. Philip and Andrew got real practical about the thing. There's always a pragmatic approach to every situation. Now, I do not discount the pragmatic approach. It's a good idea to look at our resources and see what we have. In fact, it's not wrong in and of itself. God expects us to put in all we can, to do our best, to give of what we have. I mean, if we got, you know, if we got money in our back pocket and we got a bill due, we ought to take the money in our back pocket and pay the bill, not ask God to give us no other money to pay the bill. You know what I'm saying? And so this is the deal. Do you remember I think Kirby even taught on this passage, the widow of Zarephath and Elijah. You know, what did he tell her to do before God was going to bring any miracle in her life? He told her first, you go get the oil that you have, and you go get the meal that you have, and make me a cake. In other words, you spend what you have first, and we'll let God pick it up after that. So the pragmatic and practical approach is not wrong. I put it this way. Philip got out his pencil and pad, did a little calculation, and concluded, Lord, just send them away because 200 denarii, that is 200 days' wages, will not buy enough for everybody to even get a bite of food. And so we're miles from a place with enough bread, even if we could buy it. It's a hopeless case, Lord. Send them away. Send them away hungry. And so that's Philip's pragmatic approach. He figured it out. He got his pencil and paper. He said, look, it's going to 5,000 men, and of course the women eat and the children eat, and they probably eat as much as the men eat. And so it's going to take 200 denarii. That'd just be a bite for everybody. That's not enough. I mean, it's going to be one chicken nugget apiece. You see what I'm saying? And so that's not going to be enough. So Andrew, while Philip was calculating, Andrew did a little reconnaissance, and he found a little fellow whose mom had sent him with a sack lunch. In this sack lunch, that's the Phil Winfield version. He didn't say anything about a sack, but I'm just putting the sack in there, okay? And so he sent him with a sack lunch, and in this sack lunch, he had exactly 5 barley loaves and 2 small. The word for small is diminutive. It means very little. He's got 5 barley loaves, and when it says barley, that is the cheapest of the grains. And so he had the cheapest bread, and he had the smallest fish, and those are the resources that were in the sack lunch. And Andrew came and said, look somebody sent this boy. Here's this little fella here. And the little fella is the little fella we're talking about. He's the little person with the big impact. And so this little fella has got these 5 barley loaves, which we don't even like, and 2 small fishes, which are very small. And so it's not enough, Lord. It's inconsequential. We can't do anything. Just send them away. So Andrew and Philip both decided it's hopeless. We can't do anything. Prayer meeting's over. Let's go. Let's sneak out the back, and they'll dissipate. The crowd will dissipate. They'll go home. Number 3. This is the most significant of all. So let's repeat. All right. People had a problem. Are we agreed? The lad had a lunch. Number 3, Jesus had the lad. This is the whole story. The whole story is that the little lad, when Andrew came by and said, hey, can I take your lunch and this, that, and the other? And, I mean, we don't have any record of him throwing a fit or you know, no, my mother sent me that. None of that. I mean, God had this plan. Write that down. Letter A is, it's quite simple. Jesus said, bring me the lad and his lunch. Bring me the lad and his lunch. And so the letter B, Jesus had a plan. It was a sovereign plan. Jesus had a sovereign plan. Remember that little statement, Jesus knew what he would do? Remember, he wants to do the miracle, but he also wants to teach compassion to his disciples. And he wants the disciples to know that they can show compassion because he is going to be their resource, not them. You know, we can be a whole lot more compassionate, a whole lot more helpful, and a whole lot more giving than we think we can. If we are always looking to ourselves as the final resource, then we're always limited. But if we understand that who we are, what we can do, what we own, once put in the hands of Jesus, it becomes a completely different thing. So he said to them, have them sit on this abundant grass. It was the springtime of the year, Passover. It was the first month of the year. There had been plenty of rain, so it was a comfortable situation. They sat down. Luke 19:14 says, have them sit in groups of 50. Isn't that interesting? Why would the Lord instruct under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit Luke to record that? Have them sit down in groups of 50. If they all sit in groups of 50, then they could go around, and how many groups would it take to make up the 5,000? There were 100 groups of 50, and then the families that were with them. All right? You know why I think he did that? Because these disciples and the people that are there are going to need to recount this story later, and to be able to do it accurately, Jesus had them sit down in groups so that as their baskets were filled, I get the idea that they had enough in each basket to take care of one group, and they just kept going back and forth, and they were able to feed 100 groups of 50 men plus their families. And so here's what Jesus said. He said, gather some baskets together. I'll break the bread. Basically, this is what is understood. I will break the bread, and you take it to the people, and you just keep coming back until everyone has eaten all they want, because your duty is not to provide the bread. Your duty is to pass it out. So Jesus had the resources because he had the little boy. The little boy had a little sack lunch. And I have pictured this in my mind's eye 1,000 times. What would that have been like? So Jesus has got the bread and he's got the fish, and it's just this little meager amount. And he keeps breaking it, and he fills up this basket and he fills up that. And these guys keep coming with their baskets, and there's always more. He just keeps doing this miraculous thing, and over they keep coming back, and they come back the last time. He fills up the baskets, 12 of them. He fills them all up one more time, and they look around, and who hadn't had any yet? And they're going, can't eat another bite, because that's what it says. They were all filled. Isn't that what it says? They couldn't eat another bite. There's so many things to say about this story, but this is just phenomenal. And so before he passed it out, he said, let's give thanks. And he did. Boy, that ought to tell every one of us that we ought to bow our heads and thank God for our food. I mean, that's the simplest thing that a Christian ought to do. He did that, and he began to distribute the food. It was miraculous. The scriptures say that they all ate all they wanted, and then they took up the leftovers, and the baskets were still full when it was all left over. So, letter C, Jesus had a purpose in all of this. He's going to say over and over and over in the coming paragraphs and chapters, I am the bread of life. So if you're running short on resources in life, what does Jesus say about the resources? He says, I am your resource. I am the one that can meet your need. I am the one that can feed you. I am whatever you need. Had a big tent campaign in Peru one time, and we put up this great big sign. We were going to start a church. We put up a great big sign, and the way that we advertised the campaign, we had all kinds of things going on, but great big banner, and it said, no matter what the question, Jesus is the answer. No matter what the question, no matter what the problem, no matter, you name it, Jesus is the answer. There's a place called Mala, and we ended up seeing a church get started there, and it's still going today. I am the bread of life. I am all you need. So here's what we learn. When you give all you have to God, you never do without. Now, get the picture. Now, this little fella, he had a sack lunch, and it was his, and I don't know whether his mother sent it to him or he just reached and grabbed it and got it ready and rolled it up and put it in his, I don't know. He just shows up, and they made a search, and he had that little bit of food, and he's the only one that had anything that day. Jesus took it, and he did what he did. You know, I've been in the ministry a very, very long time, and, you know, the last thing, I don't have my billfold with me tonight. I leave it in my office all the time. I shouldn't say that. Somebody's not going to come and go steal my billfold. But anyway, I never carry anything in my pockets because I don't want to jingle and all that kind of stuff. So I have been in the ministry a very long time, and I'm going to tell you right now that people will trust Jesus with their eternity, but they won't trust Jesus with their billfold. But really, I'm just being as honest as I can be, you know? I mean, in the Old Testament, under the law of Moses, that covenant, Mosaic covenant, the people were required. They had a law. It was part of how they ran their country. They gave 2.5 tithes a year. Well, actually, they gave about 23 1/3% of their money, 2 tithes and a special offering every year. Think about that. Two tithes, that'd be 23%, a little bit over 23% of their money they gave to the Lord under the law. Now, we talk about a tithe, and how much is a tithe? That's how much? A tenth. And so under the law, at certain times, at two different times, they gave a tithe of all of their income. Then Jesus said, God said in the Old Testament, I was just reading it in Leviticus, the tithe belongs to the Lord. Now, that was in the Old Testament. That was under the covenant. I don't believe it. I'm one of those that does not believe we are under that Old Testament covenant. I do not believe that we are giving to the Lord because we are under the obligation to tithe. However, the scripture still teaches that we're supposed to give him the first fruits. It still teaches we're supposed to put him first. It still teaches that on the first day of the week, we bring together the offering so that when we're gathered together, that they won't have to go hunting for it. In the first century, if you didn't bring it in on Sunday, they followed you home. And so, I mean, that's the way it was. And so bring it all in. And so, but we give to the Lord out of because of the grace of God and how he's poured it out in our hearts. It's amazing that the Jews, under the obligation of, you know, either do this or we're going to chop off your head, basically, either do this or else, they would do it. But, you know, under grace, when God has sent his only son, it's just amazing how, you know, what if that little boy didn't trust Jesus with his lunch? Right? But he did trust him with his lunch. And did he go hungry? Did he go hungry that day? What was left over? 12 baskets. I always picture this. It's just, I love this story. And I always picture it like this. Maybe there was a basket for each one of those disciples so that they wouldn't forget this lesson. They walked away from there. They got, each of them's got a basket, and they're just munching this bread as they go, remembering what Jesus has done. They probably looked down to see if it was still there even after they kept eating it, you know. But, or maybe it was one basket for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. But I have another scenario. What about this? What about the little guy comes home with the 12 disciples, each one of the disciples carrying a basket of leftovers, and they give it to the boy's mom, and the boy says, "Hey, mom, this is what was left over from my lunch after I gave it all to Jesus." Think about that. I'm not trying to say that we can give and God's going to... That's not what this is teaching. Not teaching that give and you'll get. That's not what this is about. It's talking about the abundance, the abundant God that we have, that he is not limited by our limitations. And so it's so important. Jesus truly does have compassion. He cares about the material needs and physical needs of people. And this little boy was used. He was saying he's just a little boy. All he had was these two little tiny fish and five barley breads, little buns that he had. And with that, God was able to do amazing things. So let's learn a thing or two. Write these things down quickly, and I'll be done. Number one, people have real needs. Is that true? Do people really have needs, or are they just fictitious? Now, we may not be, you know, standing in the road begging for a piece of bread, but people are standing around begging for a lot of other things. They need some direction. They need some help. They need the light. They need the truth. They need to know what to do. They need help. The second dot there, if we are growing to Christ's likeness, we will be growing in compassion. If we are growing in Christ's likeness, we will be growing in compassion. It's not a bragging point to say, "I'm not compassionate." The third dot. Sometimes the people we meet with needs are sent to us. Sometimes the people we meet with needs are sent to us to test us, to measure our compassion, to grow our faith, and of course, to meet their needs. And as we learned back in the series that we did, Concentric Circles of Evangelism, love, true love, meets needs. The next one, meeting their needs is not and was not based on their or our resources. Meeting other people. Listen, folks, we are not giving them of ourselves. Now, we sacrifice and we do like Paul did. We strive, we labor, we do those things. But we can never meet all the needs, both spiritual and physical, of the people in the world. Meeting needs is not based on our resources. Meeting their needs is based on putting ourselves and our resources in God's hands. Remember, the Lord had the lad. The people had a problem. The lad had a lunch. The Lord had the lad. Meeting their needs is based on putting ourselves and our resources in God's hands. God is not limited by our abilities. God is not limited by our abilities. When we put our little lunch bag of talents, time, and treasure, and resources in God's hands, He can do amazing things with it. So there were lessons for everybody in this story. God can meet the needs of the hungry. We can't. God can use us to meet the needs of the needy. God will use the ones who are available. Remember the little guy? He was available. God tests us through the people we meet and the circumstances we encounter. God tests us to grow us, not to tempt us to sin. He tests us to grow us through the people we meet and the circumstances we encounter. Next, God is good, powerful, and full of compassion. That's who God is. He is good, and He's powerful, and He's full of compassion. And the next one, God supplies what He requires, and He feeds us as well. That's such a blessing. God supplies what He requires. And you know, I'm going to tell you something. That's all the way through the Scripture, and there is no better example of it than at the cross of Calvary. Because God requires perfection. We couldn't be perfect. So we needed a sacrifice. And what did God supply for our requirement, for His requirement? He supplied Jesus. God supplies what He requires, and He feeds us as well. And then our duty as believers, our duty is not to provide the bread, the spiritual bread. Our duty is to pass it out. Just pass it out. Keep coming to Jesus, and He can help us have what we need to pass it out. So the question in our life is Jesus Lord of all? Is Jesus Lord? Does He have all of us? I mean, are we like that little lad that God had? You know, the little lad, the Lord, the lad, and the lunch. That's the story. The people had a problem. The lad had a lunch, and the Lord had the lad. That's the question. Does He have us? Are we in His hands? Does He have us lock, stock, and barrel? Is He truly Lord of our life? Is He Adonai? Is that who He is for us? Last Friday night, I'm going to finish up with this little story. Last Friday night, I got invited to go to the Joshua Christian Academy banquet. And it's a fundraiser. They don't make any bones about it. It's a fundraiser to try to help raise money to supply the needs for the boys and girls that are underprivileged and underfunded so that they can go to this school. And what I loved about the whole thing is it started with about 9 students, but it really, really started in the heart and mind of Pastor Keith Ratliff and maybe Chris, what's her last name? I forgot all of a sudden. Chris Hurley. And it started in their mind. It was one of those situations where the whole world was decrying the fact that these kids in these inner city schools are just not learning anything, and they certainly are just, all they're doing is getting caged up and becoming worse and worse, and nobody's teaching them anything. They certainly are not finding out anything about the Bible or about Jesus. They're just not knowing anything. Well, Keith Ratliff, instead of just decrying the situation and lamenting the darkness, he decided to turn on the light, and he trusted God. He had no money. He didn't have the resources. He didn't have the people. He didn't have anything. But he just simply said, I know what ought to be, and I'm going to trust God that it will be, and they got started. 9 students, and 15, and 30, and 50, and now they're over 130 or 40 students, and I saw those boys and girls from every nationality, majority of them from underprivileged homes. I saw them quoting Scripture and singing the songs of God, and I saw them standing up there doing all these things and just, you know, I mean, acting dignified and happy to be there and doing these things. And I looked out across that crowd, and Keith Ratliff said when he got up there and looked out across that crowd of 700-800 people that were there, he looked out there and he said, boy, he said, this is a great representation of heaven. He said, because I see people from every race sitting out here in front of me right now, and you've all come together for one reason, is try to help provide a godly Christian education for these. Is it a perfect place? No, but is our church perfect? Is your home perfect? Is everything you do perfect? No, it's not perfect. But I tell you one thing, there's a lot of kids that have an advantage now that they never had before. And, you know, he just had a little lunch. You know, Keith has had a stroke. I wasn't aware of this, but Keith has had a terrible stroke, and he was up there with his arm like this, and he had to have help get up on the platform. And he got up there and said, stood up on the platform, and he said, "Well, we've come this far by faith." I just couldn't believe it. It was awesome. And man, I was just so encouraged by that. Well, what's the whole point? Well, Keith said, "Lord, here I am. You got all of me. Here's a need, and it's got to be done. I don't know. I'm not an educator. I don't know how to do it, but here, I'm available. I'm available." That's what we ought to be, like that little boy. I'm available.